From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on May 30th in the pages of New York Magazine. Author Rebecca Traister's piece about Hillary Clinton was titled Hillary Clinton Versus Herself. The piece tackled the often repeated idea that Clinton is prone to self-inflicted problems in her campaigns. But the piece also looked at how voters tend to evaluate women who are running for office compared to men. And Traister turned to a word that can be very valuable in politics, in leadership, in business: charisma. Here's what she wrote about charisma. Quote, if a man who spews hate and vulgarity with no comprehension of how government works can become presidentially plausible because he is magnetic, while a capable workaholic woman who knows policy inside and out struggles because she is not magnetic, perhaps we should reevaluate magnetism's importance. It's worth asking to what degree charisma, as we have defined it, is now a masculine trait. Can a woman appeal to the country in the same way we are used to men doing it? End quote. And that had readers thinking. When you hear the term charismatic as it relates to leadership, who comes to mind first? We're talking politics, yes, but also business and community leadership. And Rebecca Traister is positing the idea that maybe we're subconsciously pushing women out of the realm of charismatic leaders. Now, maybe you think that's unfair or it's wrong or crazy. Maybe you can think of five women who are charismatic before you can think of one man. We'll take your phone calls on that. This hour, it's a conversation about charisma, its value, how we define it, and whether we ought to redefine it. My guests include Andrea Holland, who is a communications and public speaking coach, among many other things, and an honest to God, one of the most charismatic people I know.
Oh, well, thank
you. It's great to see you.
Yes.
Thank you for being
here.
Thank you. Heidi Zimmermeyer is here. She's the president of the Rochester Downtown Development Corporation. And I'll just preface this whole conversation with, it's not all politics. It's not all Hillary Clinton. We're going to talk about a wide range of things. And Heidi, it's great to have you and your expertise here. Thanks for being here. Also here is Kate McCardle. She's the leader of the Penfield Democratic Committee. Kate, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, I'll start with you, Kate, because we started with the sort of the political peg here. What did you make of that piece and what Rebecca Traister is saying? Clearly, she has an affinity for Hillary Clinton as a writer here,
certainly.
But she feels like Clinton is unfairly treated because of this narrow definition of charisma for women, which gets a broader berth from men. Do you agree?
Right. I do agree. I think it's a complicated term, and it's a difficult subject to really define. But the word charismatic or charisma already, I think, is a gendered term, right? So when I look at the role that women play in politics and women play in business or community, you know, I think we expect women to be charismatic, energetic, and sometimes emotional. We expect that. Not saying we all agree on what that looks like, but we expect that. And so when we don't see that in a woman, when she's possibly in business and very serious, that's when we notice it. And for Hillary, and in that article, I think what was interesting is to say, when you look at her staff and you look at the people that have been working with her day in and day out, they're shocked that people don't see that charisma, that energy, that one-on-one warmth that that she obviously has. I think her team and her political team has been trying to get that out there and showcase that for her. But unfortunately, our society, as we can see, isn't necessarily ready for it or able to see that.
Well, let me ask the communications coach. Ed Rendell, former governor of Pennsylvania, said in that piece that what her team has got to do is find the right settings then to translate that. Here's what Ed Rendell said in that piece, making the case that Clinton should try to design the job, if she wins the presidency, as much as she can around her. Quote, the president gets to select the mode of communicating. The president can go out and make speeches in front of large audiences, or the president can make the speech sitting behind the desk, talking to a TV camera. The president can do sit-down interviews. And if I were Hillary's chief of staff, I'd get her on as many of those interview shows as I could and just get her talking, not reading a speech. I'd have her do town meetings all throughout her presidency. Mm-hmm. Have you seen her in small town halls? Hillary is not a great large crowd speaker, but in those contexts, I would rate her as close to spectacular, end quote. So Ed Rendell is saying, take what Kate McCardle says about what her strengths are, amplify that. What do you think?
I would agree with that strategy as a whole. I think, especially in this day and age, you have so many mediums across which you can communicate your ideas and express your leadership, and yes, you are in that greatest position of the country to say, I'm going to choose where I want to be seen, how I want to be seen. There's a dramatic difference between a leader standing up and delivering remarks versus sitting and delivering those same remarks. If you just do that as an example, you will you poll the audience and see how they received that person. You will find a dramatic difference. And it's everything. It's from what they're wearing to what they're saying to the choice of words and the particular audiences that they're in front of. And if that is a possibility for a leader, then they should certainly take advantage of it.
And by the way, you mentioned what they're wearing. You know, I anchored television news before I got a job where I didn't have to shave and wear makeup every day. I anchored television news for a decade.
Yeah,
I didn't get one email about what I was wearing.
No, you probably didn't.
And I sat
most
next
men
to your
don't.
Sister, and I imagine.
Right.
Well,
right.
I know she
it's
did.
It's the truth. Mm-hmm. I mean, women are critiqued on their manner of dress far more than men are, and I personally don't think that's very fair at all. But it is a measure of success in the game, so to speak. So we may not like it. We can strive to change it. I think we should. But for now, it is a truth.
Okay.
And it's something that has to be dealt with.
Heidi Zimmermeyer, you're coming from, you know, most of your work in the business world. Do you disagree with this notion that, that the word charismatic or charisma has become sort of unfairly advantaging to men because men can get a broader range of behavior and styles and women are sort of expected to behave in a tighter box?
I don't think I do see that in the sector that I operate in. And I think part of what it is that if you're female, you have a lot of barriers you have to overcome in the way you're perceived. And I'm one of the older folks around the table here, and so I've seen a lot over the course of my lifetime. And I know, I can tell you, when I first got in this business, meaning real estate and business sector, I was often the youngest person and the only female in the boardroom. And that happened thousands of times. And every time I opened my mouth, it was a proving ground. Every single time for years. And that stopped happening at some point. And so I think part of that is generational and it's a shift. And it's also learning what it takes to be successful in a particular sector. I think politics is very different than business. I think no matter who you are, you're judged on a whole variety of factors that when you're in business, I really don't think are relevant. Your family, your spouse, even to a much larger degree, what you wear, how you present yourself, what your backstory is. All of those things are part of the folklore around a candidate, and they have everything to do with how people initially receive you. And in business, I think it's different. You're proving your worth. You're proving your value. It's much more content and substance driven. But make no mistake, it is a relationship business. The fact that I don't play golf, for example, for a whole generation, that was a problem. Now, a lot of people don't play golf, so it's not really relevant. But you do find that how you present yourself, you're going to give people the impression that they initially have of you. And most people are too lazy to figure it out much beyond that. So you learn very early that you can set up by how you present yourself, how you dress, how you talk, your manner, exactly how you want to be received. And I will tell you, it does work when you think very sort of gut level and very carefully about that.
Now, let me sort of mine a little bit of your own experience then, because you mentioned being the only woman in the boardroom many, many times.
Oh, yeah.
Is that still the case in a lot of boardrooms?
No.
Okay.
So
you think that's changed?
It's changed, right.
Okay. And you felt that it was a proven ground every time.
Oh, yeah.
You were speaking. So young women now who are in the boardroom, number one, you're saying there's more. And is it less of a high-pressure moment every time they're speaking in a boardroom because of that, because it's more common to see women in the boardroom?
In part, but I do think, and we were talking about this before the show began, that young people in professional positions, I, on a gut level, think that young women have a bit more to prove than young men. Mm-hmm. In the sector mm-hmm. in which I operate in. And that's very difficult to read. Is it how women dress? Is it how people present themselves? Is it a confidence issue? Mm-hmm. And I'm still trying to figure it out because of my own staff and how we operate in the community. I have all women millennials on my mm-hmm. staff, as it turns out. They just happen to be the best candidates. But it's something I've been watching and trying to figure out how you begin to develop that gravitas. It's not just about getting older. You still have to prove, yourself somewhere mm-hmm. along the way. Something snaps and you wake up and realize, I don't have to prove myself so much anymore. And so how do you get to that point?
Let me just read an email exactly on this lines from a listener named Teal. She writes, I don't think charisma is exclusively male. I think men have more opportunities and are perceived as charismatic at earlier points in their lives and careers. But I can think of a number of charismatic women, including Ann Richards, Maya Angelou, Robin Roberts, Gloria Steinem, Madeleine Albright. There are many others. Thanks for the excellent program. But on that point, Heidi, do you think earlier in their careers, men are more likely to be viewed as charismatic than women?
I think charisma is not as required. That's how I would phrase it. I don't see charisma as being so much a male or a female thing. I think it's whether or not you need more of it to be successful in the constellation of things that make a person successful. So I do think as a young woman professional in business, you're going to have to play on charisma more than probably your male counterpart. Mm-hmm. I still think that's the case.
Andrea, you wanted to jump in. Go ahead.
Well, that really just burns me up to hear you say that. I admit it. And I think you're right. And I, you know, thinking back on my career, first, let me just say, you said something happened somewhere along the line. And in my, I'm gonna age myself here, but in my life, it's called turning 30 and beyond. So something happens at that point in your life where you're
like, I'm so sorry for you.
I no longer care, right? Yeah. But there is some truth to that, you know, the whole using the golf analogy there. It's men have the opportunity, I have found in my career, men have the opportunity to have those inside jokes, the comfort level of going around the corner and talking to, you know, Bob, the VP of whatever, and saying, hey, guy, you know, having a little inside joke is available to them. It's a tool that they can use early in their career, whereas women don't or have not necessarily had that. And I think it also goes back to what are the traits and qualities we look for in genders that make those people approachable and acceptable. And for women, you know, there is that line. If you're either too forceful and you're viewed as something less than preferable.
Is the word bitch?
Okay, I didn't want to throw it out there.
I was just wondering if that's where you're going. Okay.
This is your show, brother, okay? I'm not trying to dominate it. But yeah, there's that. Or she's the funny girl. She's the funny, nice, sweet, kind girl who will, you know, take on any project you give to her just because she's nice, not because she's eager or knowledgeable or able or determined. It's just that's the nice, you know, associate who will take whatever you give to them. And that it really burns me up. But I think you are very right about that.
Mm-hmm. But do you agree with that framing, Heidi?
I think there's been a real generational shift. I no longer feel and I did for many years, that kind of inside thing with men. And you're constantly trying to find ways to get around that. I think people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, and in some ways even 50s, I don't feel that kind of barrier with men, and I haven't for a long time in the field that in which I operate. And the other thing I think is true, it was true for me starting out, but I think maybe it's a competitive issue now, is you just, no matter what you do, you need to make sure you're twice as smart and twice as prepared as the people on either side of you. In my sector, they're most often male, and they have been, but that's less and less true. I think it's really become much more unisex now than it was. And now it gets back to more personal traits. How do you present yourself? How do you work with people? When you give a presentation, does it come across as powerful? How do you use the language? Mm-hmm. What is your body? You know this. There's a lot of body language about how you look someone in the eye and shake their hand. You can learn a lot from watching the way men do this. And it doesn't mean that you give up your female traits. It means you understand what a power relationship looks like and how you start to model that for yourself. I had a lot of mentors along the way, men and women both, for which I'm grateful. And I do that for others and have for, you know, decades. But one guy, very powerful man, told me once, nobody gives you power. You have to grab it. Mm-hmm. And I've never forgotten that. It's not like you want to be a megalomaniac. It's that in a situation to make yourself a leader, you don't wait till someone hands you that baton.
Mm-hmm. No.
You find ways to become that in the settings that you're in. So I think it's more a function of all of those things.
All right, Kate McArdle, go ahead.
Just to piggyback on that, I remember early in my career, from what Andrea was saying, you know, very young, feeling like I had to be the nice person that said yes to everything. I had a wonderful, I work in the nonprofit sector and have my 12 years of my career, and had some terrific women in leadership say to me, you know, you don't have to be that person. And when you go into that boardroom or when you are presenting, remember, there's three ways to look at it, in that you can become that gender role and be a strong female leader and own the fact that you're naturally someone that's caring and charismatic, if you want to say. Or two, you can mimic the male in the room and come in and mimic what he's doing in terms of the way he's communicating or the language that he's using or going out and playing golf. Or three, you come up with your own innate natural brand, which is you, and you take the best of both of those things, because none of us fit in either of those boxes. You take what is real, and you take really critical thinking and all of those pieces of yourself, and become a good leader on your own merit. So just that was great advice, and it's something that in my professional role I've tried to do, and luckily I've had tremendous male and female leaders to mimic and to learn from in my career. I think, as we said earlier in the conversation, it's a whole nother ballgame with politics and public speaking in general, and the way that you're looked at. But in general, I've tried to do that in my own career.
Let me just say, listeners, if you want to call the program, it's toll-free. It's 844-295-TALK. 844-295-8255, or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI. 263-9994. Want to get a couple of your comments and questions in. So we'll let me start with a caller off air who called in to say that Hillary Clinton just has no charisma, no matter how you define it. Kate McCardle, this caller said, stop trying to box her into a charismatic box. She's just not charismatic. Right. And part of what I think Rebecca Traister was writing in the New York Times Magazine is why are we gravitating to people who may be, in the words of a different emailer who wrote this morning, Evan, I would rather have someone who's boring and competent than an idiot who has charisma.
Right.
But why are we gravitating toward people who may have less competence but a bigger personality? You know, so what do you think when someone says, sorry, you're not going to make Hillary Clinton charismatic?
Right.
What do you think?
Well, the first thing I would say is we're lucky to live in a democracy. So we live in a democracy, and if that's not how you define charisma, then you don't vote for her.
Or if charisma is one of your defining, that's what
exactly,
you want.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And I think the reality is many of us do gravitate to charisma, because at least the way I define charisma is in solid leadership and people that want to reach across the aisle in terms of politics, that are willing to be great listeners, that are energetic. Those are the qualities that I want in a leader. And frankly, when Hillary Clinton came and spoke here, it wasn't like I was talking to her one-on-one. I went to the audience at MCC, like many others, and listened to her. And she was charismatic to me. And I went with an open mind. I'd heard her speak before. But she was what I defined as a charismatic leader. She came prepared and energetic about specific things that were happening in the Rochester area. And that impressed me. That's how I would define it, and I see that.
Well, Bill, I'm going to come to you in just a second on the phone, but before I do, let me just cap that with the question of every 4 years, it's the who would you rather have a beer with? Should we dispense with that? I mean, like, why are we doing that? You know, who would you rather have a beer with? That will, I think I heard Peggy Noonan say one year, you know, that will always tell you who's likely to win. Who would you rather have a beer with?
Right.
I mean, I'm not hiring a drinking buddy. I'm giving nuclear codes to somebody.
Right, exactly.
You know, so do we care more? Do we care too much about that in business, politics, life, et cetera? You know, Heidi Zimmermeyer, I want friends that I want to have a beer with. I don't
know. And it's a very interesting question. And again, I think the business world is different than the political world. And I think that when you're talking about politics and why people pull the lever, figuratively speaking, for a particular candidate, it has everything to do with who they feel some kind of kinship with. And for someone, you know, there are many of us that are more about the technical capabilities of that person, you know, their leadership. But other people, they don't really need to see a platform. They don't really need to see the policies. They're voting for the person. And so this is very different. And in business, you find that shapes itself out where you'll see a contract get let with a company or a leader of a company that it's more of a friendship, and not as there's another company that probably would have done a far better job. So you do see that where the relationships and who you'd want to have a beer with, translation, as having some kind of power. And I still see that from time to time. But I do think that there's a whole wave in this country, and maybe even more with younger voters, mm-hmm. that they want to know what is the person going to be capable of doing. And so, you know, it's in the end, mm-hmm. I think the who you want to have a beer with, there are a lot of people who vote for whom that is an important yardstick. And there are a lot of the rest of us that, you know, you're looking for far more qualities in a leader.
Well, I recall Sam Harris's piece in defense of elitism, saying, heck yes, I'm elitist. I want my heart surgeon to be elite. I don't care about having a beer with him. I want my pilot to be a great pilot. I don't care about having a beer with him. Mm-hmm. And the man I'm giving or the woman I'm giving mm-hmm. the nuclear codes to, I want to be elite. Mm-hmm. I don't care about having a beer with them. But I take Heidi's point. I mean, that is sort of human nature. Andrea Holland, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, looking at charisma as a word that we're sort of shaping as we have this conversation, there's an element to charisma that in my mind says, what is it about you that I want to see or see in myself? And that generates or does not generate trust. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, yeah, you do want someone who's competent, of course. I should hope that everybody wants someone who is competent. But the natural human tendency is to look for situations where we can trust the other person. And, previous successes or failures out of the picture, I look at you and in a second I'm judging, do I trust you? Do I trust that you are not going to do me any harm? Do I trust that you will do what you say you can do? And if I get any whiff otherwise that's not the case, then people start looking at secondary cases like, so what is your past? What is your success track? What have you done before? But initially, that first contact, we do it in business. We do it in relationships. Yeah. We look at in a restaurant. You know, you look at your waiter and you go, am I trusting that you're not going to like completely mess up my dinner? You know, I mean, we joke about it, but it is true. Mm-hmm. And politics, I believe, is no different.
And objectively, Kate McArdle, looking at the polling, this isn't, I'm not wading in and making a political statement myself. I'm just looking at the polling. That's Hillary Clinton's biggest problem right now, is making sure people feel like they trust her.
Certainly.
And Andrea's point about how that plays into charisma or who do you want to have a beer with is an interesting point.
It is.
What do you think?
Well, what's really been interesting to look at is Hillary Clinton's polling when she's running for something versus when she's actually in office. I don't know the numbers right offhand, but basically, you know, when she's not running for office, when she's actually doing the job that she's been tasked to do, her polling is very high. And I see that and I read that as someone that is getting the job done. And when I talk to people about their concerns with Hillary, I always try to bring it back like we have in this conversation about, has she done the job that that you want her to do? So in looking in going back to the polling, Evan, I think that's her biggest challenge, and it will continue to be a challenge. Hopefully her campaign, and I think her campaign is smart to have her doing those one-on-ones and getting connected again to the community, because I think people will respond to that, not to mention the other choices that are out there. I think people will respond to that as well, or hopefully. But I do think there's a challenge ahead.
Okay, let me get to the phones. Bill in Brighton first up. Go ahead, Bill.
I just wanted to comment on Gail Collins' article in the Savvy Review about Hillary's mask and the difficulty that some people have had in getting to know the real Hillary. I think you only have to go back to the Benghazi committee, which is one of the most brilliant tour de forces of anyone ever appearing before any congressional committee. For 8 hours, except once or twice, with the hundreds of details she was browbeaten with. By the time the fifth hour came along, Republicans on that committee looked so inept that Roger Ailes, in extraordinary action, cut off the gavel-to-gavel coverage of Fox News and returned to the regular scheduled broadcasting. If that was a male, that would have been trumpeted all over the world. I think the challenge for the Democrats is to make her intellect one of the greatest forces of her charisma. And remember, when she ran for New York State Senator, as Gail Collins pointed out, she never resided here, and she still captured the votes, even of upstate people. Now, talk about charisma. I hope that the Democrats will get behind her and employ what are her real, honest, God-given talents.
Mm-hmm. All right, Bill, thanks for the phone call. And let me, again, we're trying not to get overtly political. Mm-hmm. You know, that wasn't the whole purpose of the hour. I understand what he's saying about that panel because it went on for hours and hours, and she got a little looser as it went mm-hmm. on. I think a little more comfortable. I mean, like we all do. We all get sort of slap happy when we're doing something for hours and hours. Maybe we get tired, but sometimes maybe you let out a little bit more of what we would call an authentic self. Mm-hmm. And what Bill's saying is she had some great moments. She started mm-hmm. to sort of punch back. She was a little more uninhibited, a little mm-hmm. less scripted. So I want to ask the communications coach in the room, mm-hmm. whether it's Hillary Clinton or maybe a business executive or anybody, and Heidi can probably talk about how we communicate in business and how we communicate in community leadership. Mm-hmm. There is a question on, can you be coached? Can you be overcoached? And as a communications coach, you know, if you find someone who tends to be overly scripted, mm-hmm. can you coach them to get away from a script and get, you know, how do you say, hey, be more natural? You know what I mean? Like it's easier said than done.
You pretty much say it like that, only you add a few other adjectives on it to make sure that they understand completely. That is not effective. I will say, so over, you know, my time doing what I do, I've had a number of different clients who are the script lovers. You know, mm-hmm. they have to. And I love scripts, by the way, having worked in media, you know, for the number of years that I did. I love a good script only because mm-hmm. it keeps you on point. It keeps mm-hmm. you focused. My days in public relations and marketing, same thing. I never let anybody jump in front of a camera without speaking points. Mm-hmm. That said, it's when you hit that barrier of someone who reads from a script that it becomes challenging. And one of the most effective ways I've actually shown this to clients is I record them. I have them write out a 60-second mm-hmm. spiel on something, and they read it. And then I say, put it down and give me the best you got in 60 seconds. And not only does their body language completely shift into a far more confident space, but also because the pressure is on that they know I have to remember all of this and get it all in there in 60 seconds, the energy is immediately boosted. They start to paraphrase and speak in their normal tone of voice, not what I call speaking brochure, which is, you know, using all the power words and adjectives that they've been told should become part of their regular vocabulary. And ultimately, I think what's really important is that the person who's being coached feels that much more capable and competent coming out on the other side of saying, I did it. I didn't read the script. I said what I had to say. I even improvised a little bit. And it was okay, or it was amazing. And once I show them that video, that is where the real sort of success and growth happens. Because I've coached people doing it, you know, without recording and just sort of letting them go at their own pace. And it's a much slower, mm-hmm. much harder mm-hmm. Progress. But if you just throw somebody in there and say, let's do it, they're on it.
What do you think, Heidi?
I think the other interesting factor in all this is looking smart. And if you contrast in a sort of global way, business environment versus politics, I think back to the debate between George W. Bush and Al Gore, where Al Gore's body language and facial expressions were negative toward. It almost looked like he was saying, "Man, you're dumb." and you'd say, and you might have argued at that point, depending on your point of view, that, you know, Al Gore really won that debate with respect to his intellectual capacity. Mm-hmm. But he didn't win the debate in terms of people's reactions to him as a leader. And so looking smart, being smart, acting smart as a politician and as a female politician, it's not a straightforward thing. And in business, I think it's much simpler. As long as, and one of the other bits of advice I've had and given many times is that if you can't describe what it is you're talking about in the 13 seconds it takes you to get from the 19th floor to the first floor on an elevator, it's too long. So the ability to be brief, the ability to condense, the ability to use language that people immediately resonate with, I think all of those things are important for politicians too. But coming across too smart or elitist or anything that kind of has a sense of that can turn around and bite you.
Big time.
Mm-hmm. Kate?
Yeah, certainly. And Hillary, as we know, is someone that is highly, she's super intelligent. And how do you take all of that information as a public servant since, what was that article, 1973, she was writing about children's rights? And how do you take all of that information and all of that experience and give a 13-second soundbite, you know, to the average citizen? It's a very difficult task. As someone that's trying to speak publicly, I was telling some stories previous to going on air, and as someone that's speaking publicly, it's a very difficult thing to do. And no matter what, when I'm speaking in public, I'm emotional and passionate. And people will say to me, oh, that's really, I can tell that you're really, really care about this issue. Well, did you hear what I said? Did you listen to the facts and the figures that I incorporated? And I think it's a difficult thing to master, and you only do that from lots of experience. And I think Hillary has had to kind of adjust over the years, and I think hopefully in the next couple of months she'll get there with the public.
It's got our only break of the hour. We're going to come back with more of your comments that have come in. Not all of them, because I'm reading some that I think I just feel like we're still somewhat stuck in a strange era with some. Anyway, we'll get to some of your comments, if not all of them, when we come back. We're talking about charisma as we define it, whether it's in a business, community leadership, politics, etc. And this was sparked by a piece in New York Magazine called Hillary Clinton Versus Herself. If you want to check that out, that's from the May 30th issue there. Andrea Holland is here, our communications coach. Heidi Zimmermeyer is the president of the Rochester Downtown Development Corporation. And Kate McCardle is leader of the Penfield Democratic Committee. More straight ahead. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, we investigate the state of long-form journalism in this country, especially in light of Gay Talese's new piece. He's the author of the new book, The Voyeur Motel, about a man who bought a motel to cut holes in the ceilings so he could watch his guests have sexual relationships. We'll talk about that. Then in our second hour, the DNC, the latest on Democratic politics. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Oh, I'm laughing because it was this debate on, do I want to read this? Listen, an email from a listener named Mark. Essentially, Mark saying, of course, men and women can be great leaders in all parts of our society, but men tend to be better public speakers. And it just makes sense that we think men tend to be more charismatic, but they can both do a great job. Andrea Holland, there's a vein that I could see that's almost touching me.
I'm silently screaming over here. We could have our own show just about that. But I loved Heidi's reaction to it. Mine was very passionate, and I just... extreme disagreement over here on my end, but what was your reaction?
It's ridiculous.
And it was said so calmly.
Quietly and...
Yes, but, assuredly.
So Mark is trying to take an egalitarian pose here. Of course, men and women can do great jobs in the boardroom and in politics and whatever it is. Just men tend to be better public speakers, is what Mark is saying. Why?
Absolutely untrue.
Mark, if you're listening, call the show. Don't email me again. Call. I want to ask why you think that.
What basis does he have on?
But hold on. Maybe Mark's point is... go back to the premise that Rebecca Traister was writing about. We tend to think more of men when we think about charismatic leaders for a number of reasons. No one said that's because men are definitionally better public speakers. But, you know, Heidi, you've probably seen people on all sides of the quality of public speaking in your career.
I think we all have. And certainly I would suggest that most people are not very good at public speaking. I think mm-hmm. it makes people very nervous. I've seen men who run huge corporations and can command a boardroom, get up in front of 300 people and go dry in the mouth. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I think public speaking is a very particular thing. Mm-hmm. Speaking to media is a very difficult thing, even if there's only three people, but one of them's got a camera on your face. That can unnerve a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So I think this is more about having the skill, the self-confidence and the skill to keep your wits about you, to keep your language sharp, to be engaging on a topic, and to be able to do that in a variety of different settings. And I think that separates successful politicians from unsuccessful ones. And I think in the business sector, that's partly how charisma is defined, is how influential, personally influential are you, And that has everything to do with the way you present yourself, how you deliver your information, how you engage with the person or people you're speaking to. So yeah, I think that sort of question pervades every sector.
Yeah, our panel hasn't agreed on every aspect of this discussion, but I think, Mark, and I don't mean to be offensive here, I think it's just sort of pure sexism to say that men are naturally better speakers than women. Kate McArdle, what do you think?
Certainly it's sexist. That's the only way to look at it. I know from my own experience, granted, I'm in the nonprofit sector, so there's a lot of female leaders around me. My experience has been the exact opposite of that. I mean, all of the women that are great, or all of the great public speakers that I know are female. The ones that come to my head, and again, that's based on experience, but his comment was just sexist.
And, you know, Andrea, I'm not going to name any names. If I think of the worst public speakers I know in this town, the first three that come to mind are men, and they always start with the worst jokes that just, I mean, it's in the class of, I just flew in, and boy, are my arms tired. And everybody's like, ugh. They always do this.
Yeah.
And I don't know who told
them.
Because
someone taught them poorly how to get into a speech or a talk. I was at an event recently where, yes, a fellow stood up and he said, I think we need a joke. And everybody in the room said, oh, God, no. Not right now. But, you know, I think skill, practice is so huge. And one thing to think about, you know, everyone thinks that great public speakers are sort of born, and it's just not true. They are practiced. They are learned in this skill, and it is, in fact, a very big skill, as well as being able to speak on camera. I traveled around for about 9 months in one of my roles when I was working for a company, and my job was to interview leadership experts on camera. And the interesting thing that I learned was I interviewed a good split of men and women, and these are executives in major, major brands and in major companies. The men always came in with a very confident perspective that what they were going to say on camera without any practice was the most amazing thing I was going to hear all day. That pretty much they had
They're
seen.
Like, I got this?
That I got this. Yeah, they sat down and they did the body language. Mm-hmm. They leaned back, open body gestures, you know, just very, just turn on your mic, little lady, and we'll just let this thing fly. And the women would come into the room with very closed body language, very nervous, not as confident. And they would say, I practiced, you know, what I was going to say to you on camera. I was asking them to tell me their most compelling leadership stories. And the women would say, I've practiced. I've given it some thought. I don't know if this is what you want, but I'm going to give it a go. And hands down, every time, the women had the better stories, the better delivery. Even though they lacked confidence, they were on point. The men told me stories that I'm sorry to say many of them were unusable because I didn't know what to do with that diatribe of stream of consciousness.
All right. So Mark, thank you for opening that can of worms, but we hope we've detonated that idea. Alexa sends an email that I think relates to both politics and business, probably relates to all different sectors that we would think about. And it's in the category of who is allowed to cry or show emotion. Mm-hmm. Alexa says that men are allowed to cry and show emotion, and that adds to their charisma. It adds a softer edge. Women do that, and they are viewed as too soft or weak. And I don't know if Alexis was intending to say that's in politics or business, but let me start with Heidi, because that kind of came up before the hour. Do you agree or disagree with that?
I think there's no crying in baseball.
Or in business.
Or in business, or in politics for men or women. I think that, and I'm not suggesting that using emotion should be calculated or passion. Mm-hmm. And I think that leaders, of male and female, business and politics, passion is part of the story. If you can't exhibit that and get people to come with you down the path, whatever it is, you're not going to be a good leader. So passion's built into this. But I think if you cry, it exhibits a loss of self-control. And I think that creates greater doubts as to your leadership capability. I wouldn't recommend it for anybody. And we've all seen male politicians implode over that kind of thing.
Yeah, Muskie and many others, yeah.
Yeah. And I think the same thing is true for women. And in business, there's no place for tears whatsoever. The only time I would say tears are appropriate are situations like 9/11 or something where there's been an extreme circumstance that has much tragedy associated with it. And at that point,
the president talking about Newtown.
Newtown, mm-hmm. those kinds of incidents, in that case, it is very real and very personal, and it allows the public in that case to connect in a way that, and they were looking for connections mm-hmm. with their leaders. So mm-hmm. I think, but that's the only case where I'd say tears are ever appropriate.
All right, so hold on. Mm-hmm. Before I go around the table here, mm-hmm. I want to ask you, are you giving me the way the business community views it, or do you personally feel that way?
Both.
You do?
Yeah.
Oh, I want to disagree with you on
that. I
think emotion is, you know, when people show real emotion, I appreciate it.
Emotion's mm-hmm. one thing. Tears are something mm-hmm. else. I mean, emotion, I mean, we're in the continuum. On the one hand, it's like a loss of control on okay. one end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. And on the other end, you're so much of an automaton, there's like no emotion.
But you don't mm-hmm. think there's men and women are viewed differently for that, whether it's business, politics?
I think if you're a woman and you cry in public, it's game over.
Mm-hmm. But men?
I think it's very negative for your reputation as a leader if you exhibit that. It's viewed as a loss of control.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it helps men or women to be in a situation like that.
Okay. So Heidi is disagreeing with Alexis's mm-hmm. premise that
yeah.
men can do that and that helps their charisma. Women, it takes away from that. What do you think, Kate?
I don't disagree with what Heidi's saying. I think in business or in the community politics, exactly what Heidi said, where you have to have a level of self-control and be able to take that passion and take that emotion and still get the job done. And we're looking for that in leaders, in in the political sense, leaders in the community, leaders in business. I think that there is a different standard. I mean, it exists. You know, when we see a man cry, we feel differently than when a woman cries. And so that standard is not the same for men and women. I think it's important to recognize that. But then for all of us in business and leadership positions to learn how to control ourselves. I'm doing it with my children every day. You know, unfortunately, we need to learn those lessons of how do we I do it with myself. Ask my husband. We need to manage that emotion and control that. And so that we can make those decisions, those tough decisions in business or in community that really take a clear mind. And if someone's crying or if someone's very angry or just so excited that they can barely be taken seriously, those are not the folks that we want in leadership positions. We can't take them seriously. So certainly, that being said, in people's personal lives, I think we should be able to accept men and women, whether, you know, they cry or they don't cry.
But Heidi wasn't talking about personal lives.
I know.
We were talking
just
about public
wanted
leadership
to make sure
positions.
We threw that out there.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm on record on disagreeing with that. I like
Good.
Emotion.
Okay.
But I take the point that tears yes. are a level that Heidi views
yeah.
as losing control. Andrea?
Yeah.
Well, I really want to know, what kind of cry are we talking about here? Is it an ugly cry? Is it a good... I'm being
cries
funny.
Are like sneezes. Some people have really elegant sneezes,
yes.
and some
and
are like,
others
wow,
are meltdowns.
Like a bomb going
yeah.
off.
And,
you know?
And yeah. Evan, would you like tears on the air? I mean, is that
okay,
a good
okay.
thing?
Okay, sorry. So hold on. This is not to make this about me, but I broke down and cried on this show a couple of months ago, and I could not believe that it happened. It came out of nowhere. It just caught me. Mm-hmm. And it's never happened, and it hasn't happened since, and I felt sort of silly about it because it was not a show that was supposed mm-hmm. to be about me. But I thought, oh my gosh, I'm gonna get killed for this. And I actually got a lot of compliments that people were saying it was very real, but I definitely lost control of that moment mm-hmm. myself. Mm-hmm.
But you're not in the Oval Office, and you're not the governor of a state, you're not running a corporation. I mean, in the role that you have in the community, it was likely entirely appropriate, mm-hmm. ironically. I don't know what the topic was, but it may have actually unleashed a lot of reaction, a connection.
The subject mm-hmm. was how
with your
I will
audience.
Eventually have to explain racism to my son.
Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. that I think is a very different kind of situation. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wouldn't feel any negativity about mm-hmm. that. In
but
fact,
can't
I think
there
it's
be
very
a business
powerful.
Leader or a political leader who may be, it may not be a new town, but it may be a moment where they weren't expecting it, but they,
I think
isn't there
can.
An opening for some of that?
Mm-hmm.
The skeptic over here, Heidi's just not buying
I'm having
it.
Trouble coming up with one.
Okay.
But
Andrea?
I'm sure there
I
is one.
I think there can. Because
It
I,
can't you know, be manufactured.
No, so. No. And so I was just about to say, like, you know, when I asked about what kind of cry are we talking about here, because, you know, there are manufactured
yes.
tears. It's like, you know, and cue the tears, and then here comes the waterworks. But I'm actually going to throw maybe a slight difference of opinion here on men versus women crying. I feel like... my experience with this, and I'm Latina, so you know, we love emotion. That's we live for it. And so watching a man cry, I think, is a further stretch in the minds of folks versus watching a woman cry. And hear me out here. When a man cries, I think the perception can sometimes be, oh, look at that. It has really affected him dramatically enough where tears would actually roll from this man's face. God, that is so authentic. Look at this beautiful moment, this person crying. I'm connecting with him. When a woman cries, it's seen as out of control. She always cries. Women always cry. Why are you crying right now? What's wrong with you? I think there's that perception as well. I think it's viewed as not authentic when a woman cries. Women are supposed to cry, right? Who was the caller? Forget his name. I'm sorry. women are supposed to cry. That's right. What they do. Right. And so when they cry, it's just every day they cry. Right. This is, you know, they're just being emotional. It's an emotional blip. When a man cries, oof, that's authentic.
Okay, but you're not buying it, Heidi Zimmermeyer.
I'm suggesting that in... speaking strictly in the sort of conventional business world, I think it's viewed in either case as a sign of weakness, of
inability
to be have self-control. And then that calls into question your ability to lead consistently.
Okay. Are women more are men more forgiven for crying than women?
I don't know. No. John Boehner got chastised for it, but I mean that man cries if his frosted flakes weren't in the congressional dining hall.
That's just it. Yeah,
always crying. So that was okay. Well, anyway, let me get back to the phones. Keith, next up. Go ahead, Keith. Oh, Keith, I hear your radio. Turn it down, man. Okay. Come on.
Sorry. It came to me within the half hour on hold.
Okay, go ahead.
Heidi's comments about men crying, I see nothing wrong with men showing emotion. Now, we're not talking about some guy bawling his eyes out or something like that, but they can show even happiness or anger or joy or sadness. I don't have a problem for it. I mean, I'm not a John Boehner fan, but I felt great empathy for him when he lost it there. But what I wanted to speak about was public speaking. You touched on that. I used to be a stutterer, and it was so bad that I think all through high school I never asked one question because I was afraid I was going to stutter. Now, as you well know, I'm a constant caller, and I don't know what the transitioning point was, but I think it had to do with humor. And I have no problem speaking, starting a conversation with a perfect stranger. But I do know personally many of your listeners are afraid to call in because they say they just don't want to be heard on air because they're afraid.
Well, I mean, I think to Andrea's point and maybe to Heidi's point, thank you, Keith, that most people are probably not natural public speakers, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. That's just... that's encoded in the human condition. That's not a male or female thing. Mm-hmm. That's a human condition thing. Talking in front of an audience is something to get used to. Any short ideas on how to work on that, Andrea Holland?
Practice. Mm-hmm. I mean, it amazes me that people think, you know, they can go their entire career learning their particular skill set and honing their particular experience. But then when it comes time to get up and speak, they think, just wing it. Let's just get up and try this. I think Mark Twain it takes 3 good weeks to write a good impromptu speech. It's so true. You have to make it an effort. You have to practice.
Mm-hmm. Matt writes to us on Twitter, the best convention speaker was Representative Barbara Jordan in 76. Charismatic and strong leadership. Charisma is gender neutral. That's from Matt. Elizabeth writes, right or wrong, charisma often brings confidence and authority. Scientists and doctors and politicians need to communicate to their audience. And then she says, look at what the Alda Center is doing for scientists. Doc Murray, I don't know about the Alda Center, but now I want to check that out. That's interesting. It says they work to help scientists interact more effectively with the public. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting point she's making because we all know great scientists. We all know great scientific communicators. Mm-hmm. And when I find someone like an Adam Frank, you know, whoever it is who's a great communicator, I want them in the studio as much as I can because they're not only brilliant, but they communicate so well. Mm-hmm. That's probably true in business as well. There's probably speakers who, you know, the Downtown Development Corporation has on the roster more than others for those reasons.
I think it's an issue of it's the content question. I think when you speak and you really know your stuff, I think your confidence level is different, and I think your chances of being very much more effective and being a powerful speaker are go up considerably. And I think when your topic, your subject matter is very technical, it takes twice as good a communicator to be able to get people interested, mm-hmm. to have people understand, to be able to use the language in a way that sort of overcomes these I don't get what you're saying kind of barriers. So mm-hmm. I think in the end, it's all gets down to being able to communicate and communicate effectively.
I mean, when I first met Kate McArdle, I felt like you, first of all, you have a, you know, you're easy to talk to, and I think you're a very good communicator. To Heidi's point, and whatever the material, you have to know it really well, but how do you make sure you know it well enough that so well that you almost can, you can almost riff a little. I mean, you almost want to know it so well that you're not just relying on a script, right?
Right. And again, to Andrea's point, it's practice. I mean, it's practice and it's engaging. And this is sometimes where women may stereotypically do a little bit better than men is getting other people's opinions. So the man that you were referencing that comes in to tell the leadership, you know, he didn't ask anyone about what you know, what he should say. Sometimes we may be better public speakers because we're asking for additional opinions. We're asking for input. You know, hey, I'm going to do this presentation, and what do you think about this slide? Or what do you think about what I'm going to say this about this technical piece? And so I see that a lot in it's getting input from others and taking that input and making your speech, making your communication style better and more technically accurate. One point, I work at RIT and I work with a lot of technical engineers and, you know, I'm their go-to in terms of explaining what is happening a lot of times and to engage the public in here is what we're doing because many of those people are highly intelligent, terrific, doing a great job, but to the masses maybe can't explain that what's actually happening in our work
Absolutely. environment. Absolutely. And Heidi, what's the floor, the elevator to the what to what, you said?
19th floor to the first floor, 13 seconds. You got to be able to get your point across.
And harder than ever when it's engineering and technical stuff. But really interesting stuff from our panel this hour, and I want to thank you all for being here. Andrea Holland, who's a communications coach, great to see you.
Good to see
thank
you, my
so
friend.
Much. Kate McArdle, among other things, the leader of the Penfield Town Democrats. It's great to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Heidi Zimmermeyer from the Rochester Downtown Development Corporation. Next time I cry, I'm going to think of you, Heidi. Thank you.
Thanks. It was
great
fun.
Great to see you. Thanks to Rob Braden, our engineer, and Megan Mack is the producer of this program. Taprina Gudboldo is the intern. I'm Evan Dawson, and we'll talk to you Tuesday on Member Supported Public Radio.